This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
This National Health Insurance Dialogue is proudly brought to you by RH Bupilo and Sakiwo on Power 98.7. Now we are talking.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Aldrin Simpier. I'm the host of Power Talk, as my boss has indicated. And indeed, yes, I did dress up for this special occasion. Normally, I dress up for television, but hey, sometimes you do it for radio as well. And Prabob, I hope that there is a salary hike coming in, you know, because I've gone the extra mile, you know. So today's focus is the NHI bill. It has been a conversation and a debate that has been happening and going on for the past couple of years. We've even now changed ministers, so there's a new minister in place whose task it is to make sure that the NHI bill or the NHI is implemented. But by the look of things, it doesn't seem that it would happen under this minister's tenure. Well, at least not under the current administration, as the goal is set to have it all implemented by the year 2026. So, ladies and gentlemen, please feel comfortable to ask any question that you have, any comments that you may have as well. And if you want to debate, let's debate. For our listeners listening at home, please use the hashtag PowerDialogue or hashtag NHIDebate, that is hashtag NHIDebate, or hashtag PowerDialogue. And remember that you can tweet at Aldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk as well, and also tweet at PowerFM987. We will be taking your calls throughout the conversation on 0861-987-000. And as I've indicated, that you can tweet as well and be part of this debate and discussion that is currently taking place. So I'm going to introduce my panelists quickly, and then the discussion then begins. And let's hope that by the end of this conversation, you would know what the NHI bill is all about. And when the rounds of public consultation makes their way to the province, which would be towards the end of this month, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's on the 21st of February, towards the 25th of February here in Gauteng, so that you can make your submissions as well with regards to the NHI bill. So I'm going to introduce my guest, starting off with the panelists that we'll be starting off with now during this conversation. And then in the second hour, we'll also have a different panel. We start off with Dr. Anban Pillay, who's the Acting Director General and currently holds the position of the Deputy Director General for the National Health Insurance at the National Department of Health. We also have Dr. Donald Gumede, who's the Chairperson of the National Healthcare Professionals Association. We also have Sibongile Shabalala, who is from the Treatment Action Campaign, and Dr. Rajesh Patel, who is the Head of Benefit and Risk at the Board of Healthcare Funders of South Africa. And you know that this conversation is brought to you proudly in partnership with RH Bupilo as well as Sakiwo. We'll hear from them just a bit later on. But let's start off this conversation by speaking to Dr. Pillay. Dr. Pillay, welcome and thank you so much for being part of this conversation and the discussion that we're having today. Starting off with what is the NHI and how does the NHI benefit me?
Thank you very much. Good morning to the audience and the listeners.
The NHI is basically a funding mechanism that allows us to pool our funds from the entire country, the entire citizenry of South Africa, into a single fund and buy healthcare services on behalf of all South Africans. So we're moving away from our current system of a two-tier healthcare financing system where the rich are separated from the poor based on their financial status. That type of system obviously discriminates against the poor and promotes barriers to access. On the side of the rich, obviously those that are on medical schemes, their cost of healthcare has been going up astronomically. So having a single fund allows you to then to contain the costs because you're able to negotiate much better tariffs as a collective rather than having individual schemes purchasing services on behalf of South Africans.
Okay, but for a person who doesn't have a medical aid, how does this benefit them?
So somebody who doesn't have a medical aid currently would access services largely through the public sector unless they're paying cash and going into a private sector facility. they would now be able to go into their GP and have services delivered to them in the community that they live. They could go to the pharmacy that's close by and get their medicines. They would go to the dentist, the physiotherapist, the optometrist, etc., without having to go to a state facility and queue up for those long queues and wait a long time in order to access those services. Because there are a number of private providers at the primary care level that would be able to provide many of these services. People are not accessing them because they can't afford that. Mm-hmm. But if you had a collective pool that can buy services on behalf of everybody, that changes the dynamic and obviously would improve the access.
Mm-hmm. So it means that the private hospitals would still exist?
Yes, private hospitals will exist, and they would obviously have to change their business model about how they currently provide services. Mm-hmm. Predominantly, most people that go into private hospitals have a medical scheme membership. I would anticipate under the NHI, the majority of people that would be using the private hospitals would be those that are under the NHI. So the fund will buy those services from those hospitals, mm-hmm. not as a single medical schemes, but as a large fund.
Okay, let's bring in Sibongile Shabalala, the treatment from the Treatment Action Campaign. She's the chairperson. Sibongile, listening in to what Dr. Pillay has said, do you feel that this is the right scheme to benefit the ordinary South African?
Honestly, it is a right scheme, but the bill, the problem that we have, it's a bill, the way it's crafted. But we don't have a problem with an NHI because we believe on universal health coverage, and we believe that poor people, they need to get quality healthcare services. But we are not happy about the bill.
What is it specifically in the bill that you're not happy?
With the bill now, it gives so much power to the minister, of which we are not happy about that. As you see now in our country, there's a lot of corruption. A few weeks back, we just had allegations against the current minister to say he appointed his niece to the higher position. So if we give so much power to the minister, then people who will be appointed as an NHI CEO, NHI fund, and other structures that will be there will be appointed by the minister, and the board will be appointed by the minister, and they report back to the minister. So there is no accountability there, and there's too much power to the minister. Mm-hmm. So which that it doesn't.
So the powers that the minister have, your biggest issue is the appointment of who will head the NHI fund, who will be CEO, who will be part of the board. Is that your biggest concern?
Our biggest concern is that the power sits with the minister. Mm-hmm. The power sits with one person, and you cannot give all that power to one person. So to say who will be the NHI board, who will be the NHI fund CEO, whatever, that it doesn't concern us. But where is transparency if the minister has so much power, and where is governance coming in? Where is civil society coming in and engage on these issues, on what is happening through NHI, when the NHI fund is all the powers are allocated to one person?
Okay. Let's then continue the conversation. And remember that you can be part of the conversation by calling on 0861-987-000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. Is it your sense as well that the minister has too much powers when it comes to the NHI? Have you gone through the bill? What's your assessment of the bill and what exactly it is that the bill is trying to respond to? Dr. Donald Gumede, let's speak about the professional association and how the professionals think about this bill and how this bill would benefit, first of all, the ordinary South African, but what about the professionals?
Thank you very much. Good morning to everyone. As professionals, National Healthcare Professional Association represent a wide variety of professionals, your doctors in the form of GPs, specialists, pharmacists, physiotherapists, and all that. The concept, it sounds good because it's a one-stop shop, which encourages practitioners to work together. So meaning you'll have your GP there probably, and then you're going to have your physiotherapist, you have a dentist, you have got a pharmacist. Mm. So it's like a medical center. So it's like a family practitioner-oriented type of a setup. Having said that, we are concerned about few things as well as practitioners, because the methods of payments has not been outlined properly, and I think that is the biggest issue. But we understand that is because, like you rightfully said off air, that not this administration, because now I think the current administration is trying to lay down the foundation on how things should work or system mm-hmm. should work. Yeah. So as long as we agree on the fact that the practitioners must be paid or compensated very well, and the patients must benefit, because health, it's a right to tell the truth. It's not a commodity. It's not something that it should be bought. It's actually something that it's engraved in the Bill of Rights, mm-hmm. Section 27.
As professional practitioners, are you at all concerned that there could be caps that are put on?
Yes, actually we discussed that, because it should not happen, actually, because the compensation commissioner, I think, it wouldn't like caps being put around. So we have to have maybe variety of prices. That's why even in private sector, they've got each medical aid consultation is different from the other one. But I will surmise or assume that actually the government as a one purchaser might negotiate one price, which I don't know how they're going to go around it. Probably Dr. Pillay will elaborate on that, because that's our fear, because they might cap use like a network facility like they used to do the private sector, mm-hmm. where they put a cap to say you can only charge 100 rand to see a patient, and whether that 100 rand is enough or is not enough is none of their problem. Mm-hmm. So that we don't think that it should be.
Okay, Dr. Pillay, do you have an answer to that?
Yes. So on the method of payment, in the white paper, we've outlined that the primary method of payment at primary care level will be capitation, which means that people within a particular area will register with their primary care provider, which would be the GP, and other related primary care providers like your pharmacist, dentist, physio, etc. And then the fund would get into a contractual agreement with those providers and reimburse them on a monthly basis, a fixed amount linked to the risk that mm-hmm. they've taken on in terms of that population.
Would it be a price, a standardizing of the price across the board, or would it also take into consideration, for instance, where the GP is placed, the lease that the GP has signed, for instance, because the property, for instance, in Houghton is much more expensive than leasing property in Soweto.
Okay, so in addition to method, which was the first part, the second part, I suppose, is about how much we'll reimburse.
Yeah.
The key principle is that the reimbursement must cover the costs of the practice and provide the practitioner with a reasonable income as a salary for running a practice. So clearly, there will be practice cost studies that will need to be done. We would need to understand that. We would also need to understand the utilization of the services in a practice. So you may have one practitioner that has higher risk patients where he or she needs to spend more time with them compared mm-hmm. to another practitioner. Mm-hmm. So you can't simply reimburse them on the same level. You need to take account of those kinds of things, because they'll need more medicines, etc.,
yes.
and tests. So we'd have to take account of those risks in setting the tariff. So you can't have one tariff for everybody, because the risk is different.
Okay, and let's bring in Dr. Rajesh Patel into the conversation as well. He's the head of benefit and risk at the Board of Healthcare Funders of South Africa. Dr. Patel, your take on this particular question, and this is around the issue around caps, and then we'll get into the concerns that the medical aid companies have raised as well.
I think the issue of remuneration for providers, there's two components. One is the amount you pay them and how you pay them. Mm-hmm. The second component is what value you buy for that money you're paying over. The critical component is not always what you pay and how you pay. It's also monitoring that the quality of care delivered is good. When you buy into the concept of universal healthcare coverage, that's the ultimate goal that we
yes.
want to try to achieve. And NHI is one vehicle to try to help you get there. You need to make sure there's access to intervention, and that would be included in the remuneration and the cap issue. And you have to have caps because there's limited resources available. The second important thing is make sure there's quality of care delivered. And you have to be measuring that all the time. So it's not just a question of implement NHI, pay doctors, all hunky-dory. You need to make sure the systems of measure, accountability and audits, etc., are all in place. The third critical component of universal healthcare coverage is to monitor the amount of out-of-pocket payment that goes into health. And critically, what you want to do is to make sure that this is reducing over time. And it doesn't necessarily mean you need to have an NHI to be able to do this. In a medical scheme environment, you can start doing that right now as well, reducing that out-of-pocket payment. But first, you've got to start measuring it, get a sense of what it is like, and then work towards.
But isn't the complaint right now that when it comes to medical aid, there are different packages available, and what the NHI is trying to do is come up with a comprehensive answer so that every single South African has access to quality health, whereas with the medical aid, It is based on the package that you're on.
The package is dependent on how much money you've got in your pocket.
Exactly.
And I think that's part of the problem, the historical problem in the way the Medical Scheme Act was structured. It has led us to this over the years, and if you see the Medical Schemes Act amendment, the previous proposals before that kind of thing, the recommendation is to move towards a single plan with income contribution tables for everyone on that plan.
Okay, so 0861-987-000. We'd love to hear from you. You can also tweet at Alderan St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and also tweet hashtag NHI debate, as well as hashtag Power Dialogue, which we are currently having, the focus, of course, being on the NHI bill. And as I've indicated earlier on, that towards the end of this month, there will be public consultations that will be taking place in the province. So we hope that we'll be able to answer all the questions that you have in relation to the NHI bill. Dr. Pillay, going back to workers, if you are employed, the company has a certain medical aid scheme that the company has acquired services from. What does this mean for the company, and what does this mean for the employee?
So basically, in the context of a closed scheme, which is employer-based, the employer will make a contribution into the NHI fund, and the employee as well, if he or she is above a particular income bracket, mm-hmm. will make a contribution into the NHI fund for the benefit package that the NHI offers. Clearly, if the company chooses beyond that to have additional benefits that the NHI fund doesn't cover, then that medical scheme will
so that will be the complementary services.
That's right, yes.
So the company can still have a medical aid scheme, and does this mean that as an employee,
yes.
you are then forced to also sign up? Or do I have a choice as an employee to say that I don't want to be part of the medical aid scheme because I already have NHI?
Well, complementary cover by its nature usually is voluntary,
yeah.
as medical schemes are currently.
Mm-hmm.
So one would anticipate that that would also be the environment in which mm-hmm. we're operating.
Does this not take medical aid schemes out of business?
Well, medical schemes are currently voluntary, and the 15% of the population belong to them,
yeah.
largely because of the income disparities and the quality disparities in access to services. I think that under the NHI, the fund will clearly be able to provide a comprehensive set of services, but there will certainly be services that the NHI fund will not be able to afford to provide for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for those services, people will probably want to purchase a medical scheme to deal with those.
Yeah. Yeah, would those be cosmetic surgeries, for instance?
Yes, that's one particular example.
Yeah.
There are similarities in terms of the other areas that you could get mm-hmm. into. So the NHI fund, for example, if we took medicines, would have a formulary, and those would be the medicines that the NHI fund will reimburse.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, individuals may choose not to want to purchase those medicines because they don't like them or they prefer something else. Then obviously that would become complementary cover.
Okay. Dr. Patel, do you at all think that the NHI will push medical aid schemes out of business?
I think if you're referring to the complementary cover, it's an issue that you need to look at the time frame of reform.
Yeah.
In reality, if you do believe in complementary cover, as the Department of Health has indicated, then it's potentially one of the last interventions. Unfortunately, right now, the whole NHI and a lot of these issues have been politicized.
Mm-hmm.
That medical schemes will go under. Critical, the NHI bill, it's about setting up the fund, making sure the governance is right and the operations of the NHI fund is right. The complementary cover has got nothing to do with the NHI bill. So its presence in the bill, you have to raise questions as to why it's there in the first mm-hmm. place. It's got everything to do with how you run a medical scheme. So if there is interest in this type of thing, then you put it in a Medical Schemes Act, not necessarily the way it's been written out currently in the bill. So that's partly problematic. And to me, it's like, why do you want to raise the issue of complementary cover this early in the whole reform process when it's one of the last interventions you'd actually want to implement after you get the NHI up and running, the whole thing working together, working smoothly, getting the alignment with medical schemes? Then you start implementing it at a far later stage. Mm. That's if that is still government policy. But to me, it's like a red herring that's going around, or the other way to look at it, it's a tail wagging the dog scenario. Yeah.
Dr. Kumet, I see you nodding there.
Yeah, I understand the medical aids. You see, like Dr. Pillay has rightfully said, they serve a small margin. I'm going to give you statistics now. You see, nationally, the public hospitals are around 347 as per the official in 2012 documents. I don't know how many were built since then, Dr. Pillay. And then the private hospitals, they are running around 200 and something. So if you look at the ratio of the private and public, the private actually is the one that is causing the disparities in the health sector. Because according to the World Health Organization, we should be spending 5% of our GDP on health. At this point in time, we're spending around 9%. And majority of that, it goes to private. And it's serving the interests of the 15% of the elite.
Yeah.
And now, why we support the NHI is because we're saying, if these hospitals, all of them, were used for a common purpose of providing health, then we would have a proper healthcare system. Mm-hmm. But then the problem is one. You see, you have these private giants, your Netcare, if I were to put that, who are running NHI in UK. They are the ones who are running NHI. And MediClinic, they are running the private sector there. So what the question that you ask, whether the private will die or not,
yeah.
The private won't die. It will still then be competing with the NHI, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
That's why even in the UK, NHS is still being competed by the private sector.
But isn't it because in the UK, what they've been doing this for over 40 years now?
Correct.
So they've come up with solutions and there were hiccups along the way.
It's actually more than that. The NHS was established in 1948 by Nurse Bevan after the World War II. So it has been a long system, but it's not yet even perfect, even up to now. Because you see, there are interest groups who want to make money out of the health system. And what we're saying is, let's not make health a commodity.
Yeah, who are those interest groups?
It's the private sector. That's okay. Why probably Dr. Patel talks like that, because they are protecting their interests. Let's be fair.
Okay, so we're going to go to the Power News headlines. So when we come back, let's debate that. Let's debate whether or not there are private interests that are trying to benefit out of the health sector and how they've done that. And then, of course, we'll also glimpse over the Competition Commission's report around what's happening in the medical industry. Let's go to Power News headlines.
This National Health Insurance Dialogue is proudly brought to you by RH Bupilo and Sakiwo on Power 98.7. Now we are talking.
And we continue our conversation and debate now on the NHI. And this is where we have a conversation about who wants to have their hands in the cookie jar. Is it the state? Is it the private players? Because the Competition Commission has come up with a report that indicated how hefty prices are within the private sector for healthcare, going as far as saying that we found that utilization rates, that is hospital admission rates, level of care admission to high care and intensive care units, and length of stay were higher than can be explained by the burden of disease of the population being cared for. We found that excessive utilization was a significant driver of healthcare costs. So earlier on, we heard from Usibongile Shabalala, who indicated that if you look at the powers that the minister has and concerns around corruption currently in the country, that's the reason why some people look at the NHI bill and say, whoa, can I really trust the minister to be the custodian of an NHI fund? That's the biggest concern, right, Usibongile?
That's
okay.
True.
Now Dr. Kumete brings in another element to the conversation and argues that it is actually the private sector that are greedy, for lack of a better description. Dr. Patel?
I can talk on behalf of medical schemes and administrators, and upfront we must say that the private sector, particularly at the funding level, etc., you've got about 180 billion rand is grossly inefficient, and that's come out in the health market inquiry. There's a lot of things that can be changed to make it efficient. Some of the problems are structural in the legislations, etc., and some legislations are in place, but they're not necessarily implemented, and I don't think we'll go too much into the detail. The component is, yes, there's room for a lot of reform in the private sector and the funding environment. We must do that. Equally, there's sufficient reforms that are needed at the service provision level as well. If you have an environment, for example, where the quality of care is not great, you're going to have a lot of complications. That adds to the utilization and the cost. So there's a whole lot of components that you really need to fix. It's not just the corporates, it's a whole lot of service provision, quality, etc., access to sufficient interventions. We commented on other current packages
that,
adequate.
Does that mean that the price is, or the cost rather, the cost drivers, explainable why people pay so much money in the healthcare sector, especially private sector? Let's leave out the inability, for instance, of the public health sector to meet some of the quality standards that are in place.
There's quality problems in the private sector. I don't know why we believe there's problems in the public sector only. Mm-hmm. There's serious problems in the private sector, and we're just not aware of it. And it hasn't really been made public. That's the important thing that we need to note here. The inefficiency issue, there's no doubt. It's present. It's inherent.
Yeah.
The question is, are we really committed to want to make those changes now? BHF has tried to bring its membership on board to try to make some changes voluntarily until the government is ready to make some of those regulatory changes that are needed out there. Is there price inefficiency? Yes, government has implemented medicine price control. You saw that initial 17-19% decrease in cost of medicines, and we're now seeing that steady rise. But what about the equipment, the device, the materials, mm-hmm. and the pricing misrepresentation that's actually going on out there and has been going on for a long time? You need that under control as well. Dr. Gumede raised the issue about remuneration. Primary care is not so much of a problem. The remuneration of specialist levels is quite high. The cost of hospitalization is significantly high. And it's not just the cost of service. Like you commented earlier, it's the level of utilization.
Yeah.
Because we've got a HPCSA that's got an ethical rule that people can go to any practitioner of their choice, for simple primary care things, you go to a specialist and you end up paying the higher rate. What could have been actually avoided if there was a gatekeeper function that was present. If you look at most medical schemes right now, the top three to top five reasons for admission includes two common things that are there: pneumonia admissions and gastroenteritis, the diarrheal problems in there. Most of those, if you have good primary care benefits in place and good primary care delivery, most of that can be actually avoided. Mm-hmm. So the question comes in as to, are medical schemes putting the right benefits in place? And right now the PMB is a mandated benefit. You have to provide for that. There isn't sufficient primary care. We've got to push in that direction to include a lot more primary care component. You then have to bring the service providers along to make sure there's quality of care delivery of that package, primary care package you put in place. I know the CMS is busy with some draft. I know the Department of Health is busy with the NHI package and wants to make sure between the private sector and the public sector there's alignment of the primary care package. And to me, that's the critical starting point if you want to address the inefficiencies. There's sufficient evidence out there over the years that shows if you deal primary care properly, you can potentially reduce your referred care costs by up to 25%. Mm-hmm. You know, so to me the issue is right now is, let's start building a house with making sure we have the right foundation in place.
Dr. Kumete, do we trust government with our money?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, as a matter of fact, we wrote one of the chapters, made recommendations on the bill that went to Parliament, that because you also have issues with the fact that one person in particular, we know that he's the captain of the health industry, mm-hmm. The minister, but we also felt it's uneasy about that, like giving the whole money to one person, and then he controls the whole purse. But let me just go back a little bit so that I answer you get the gist of the answer. The Department of Health this year, they were allocated, I think, around 235 billion. And of that, 70 to 80%, depending on which province you're talking to, it's going to human resource. Now, yes.
Salaries.
Now, you're remaining with a small margin. You're remaining.
Do you agree with that?
Sorry?
Did you agree with that? I saw you nod. I thought it was in agreement.
No.
But you do agree that the salary bill is around 70 to 80%?
It's 65%.
65%.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I was in Limpopo, the MEC, that's at 80%. So okay. That's why I said 70 to 80. It's fine. Then they are left with around 20%, let's say Limpopo. So they're left with 20%. In that 20%, they have to create infrastructure. They have to maintain it. They have to buy medication. It's not plausible. It's not possible. Because that's why, if you listen to my statement, MediClinic started building hospitals in 1986. There were three of them. And then two of them, they were still under construction. And so in 1989, they had five hospitals, MediClinic. Now they've got 53, you see, hospitals. So from 1989, they've got 53. Netcare, it was founded in 1996. They've got 120 hospitals. Life as well, it has got 53 hospitals. Not talking about Kleenex and the other ones, the small ones. Now, what I'm trying to say to you is the private sector have been proliferating. They've been creating more hospitals. Which hospitals have you had ever since our new dawn that the government has built? And they were opening.
The one in Jabulani, the one in Natalspruit.
Yes, exactly. Medium, whatever hospitals. But how many did the private build comparatively? You see, and it's because the private sector has more money than the government to spend on infrastructure. So I would say that the government doesn't want NHI. They need NHI because that's their only way to salvage the health system, to be honest. Because at this point in time, even next year, even if they were to be given 350 billion, they won't be able to create more hospitals and more infrastructure and whatever. It's not going to be possible.
Ms. Mongile, is it possible to look at the two sides and identify which one is the better devil?
Unfortunately, there's no better devil in this case. Because you look at what private sector is giving. Yes, it's a quality healthcare service, but it's very expensive. So for a poor person, like for instance, I'm living in Fort Lauderdale. There's a clinics hospital next to me, but I can't afford to go there because if you go there, one consultation, you have to pay about 5,000 rands, depend on the doctor that you are consulting. And it's not even regulated. So if a person next to the hospital cannot be able to go to that hospital, then I cannot say private sector is a better devil because it has all the machinery. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have the Department of the Public Sector. We have a Telemo Khorane Hospital right in the same area. But when you look at the quality of healthcare service between the two, it's totally different. People rather die than going to Telemo Khorane because as much as that hospital is built after 1994, but it has a lot of problems. Just in December, there were leaks in the hospital, and there are cracks, and there are not enough beds. People are spending 3 days in a casualty. So you decide as a person to say, rather buy food or go to hospital. So people are not going to private hospital because they have money, but because they want help, they want to live. And they don't attend public hospitals because the quality of healthcare services that we are getting out of public.
But the intention, Dr. Pillay, is to standardize
quality.
Quality.
Yes.
So both public and private.
Yes, the Office of Health Standards Compliance is a regulator of that quality. So the minimum standard is set by the Office of Health Standards Compliance.
Okay.
And every facility at the point of the introduction of the NHI will have to be compliant for the fund to to actually contract with that.
Okay, so we're going to open up the floor. Any questions and comments that you have in relation to the conversation that we're currently having on NHI? And remember that you can also tweet at Alderman St. Pierre, use the hashtag NHI debate and hashtag power dialogue. And remember that you can also call us on 061-987-000. But some of the questions from the floor that we're going to start off with. Good morning. Sure, just quickly introduce yourself and then your comment or question.
My name is Bongani Khadebe. I think I have two short questions.
Okay.
For me, I'm coming from a school of effective and disciplined execution. Sisilo, which is from Fosloras, I'm from that side. There is Wutsilong Private Hospital, there's Terre, that one. Mm-hmm. Now, NHI is open. We know Wutsilong has got a quality service that is providing. How will they be ready to allow all of us? Because all of us, once NHI is there, we're going to be flocking to Wutsilong Private Hospital. Is the government, will they be able to take advantage of that numbers? But two, question number two is that it's important that policies must be implemented. Will I be having a choice as a person to say, I choose not to be part of NHI, I want to be in the private health office? Like a simple, we've got legal aid. Mm-hmm. You go there, Adrian, ungenamal, we are fire fan. You spent 10 years in jail. But if I have money, I can go to Dalimpofu and be secured. Will we not be creating that situation that the capacity that you have opened, you're going to be creating a legal aid kind of a scenario where whoever goes there is just going to jail for 10 years? But if I've got money to go to Dalimpofu, I know I'm safe. Those are the two questions.
By the way, I haven't committed any crime. Any other question? Okay, let's go to, is it Dr. Osborne? Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, sir. Yeah, my name is Dr. Osborne Manjana. I'm from the organization called 360 Health Administers CISO Medical Fund. My question is, how is the government going to afford the NHI? Currently, government is collecting around 1.3 trillion rands in terms of tax revenue, mm-hmm. and then they spend 1.8 trillion rands. So it means a difference of 400 billion rands they have to go and borrow. We know that credit bureaus, which is the Moody and them, they're saying enough is enough, you've borrowed enough, going now. Eskom has got a debt of about half a trillion rands, and some of it is being stolen. SAA is collapsing, PRASA is collapsing. If NHI is being created, it's going to be the biggest SOE mm-hmm. or the state-owned company or enterprises. And we know at the moment that government is spending on health around about over 200 billion, 220 and 180 for private health care. And in private health care, for 9 million people, there's like 15% of the population, they're spending 180. Yep. And the Council of Medical Aid Scheme, it said 23 billion of that is fraud, waste, and abuse. Mm-hmm. So you assume 150 is a true health care and quality. I know they said they're going to control prices. So if you do a simple back of the match maths, you need close to a trillion rand to mm-hmm. be able to treat okay. this. How are they going to be able to afford it? And then just a quick second question. They mentioned complementary services for medical aid scheme. Just to give an example, I've got a father who's over 80 years old who suffers from chronic renal diseases. If he had to go to the public sector, he'll be rationalized. He won't be get dialysis. Mm-hmm. So if that means now, at the moment, I can buy that service from a private, from the medical aid. In future, it means that even if I've got the money to buy it from a medical aid, he cannot get that service because he'll be rationalized because medical aid service schemes will not be allowed to provide the same service that NHI thinks. So would we go to Botswana now or we have to go to Dubai, all of us, to get healthcare?
Dr. Pillay, just those four questions quickly. The first one, of course, being the issue around the funding and how much it will cost us. I know the number that has been bandied about was that half a billion, but some are saying that it's actually close to a trillion.
So the NHI will cost as much as the country can afford. So what do I mean by that? It's like saying, well, how much does it cost you when you go shopping to the supermarket? It depends what you decide to put in your trolley, and that will dictate how much it's going to cost you. So you go into the supermarket knowing how much you can afford, and then you select the items in the supermarket based on that. The principle in NHI will be exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Depending on how much of money we have allocated, we will then develop a benefit package and provide those services.
What's linked the estimate to that. Now?
Well, it's 256 billion inflated, basically.
Mm-hmm.
At this stage, that's what Treasury said they will be able to afford to allocate to the fund.
Is this in addition to the current 200 billion that we have now spending?
In the public sector.
Yes, in the public sector.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So it's in addition to that. So it'd be like half a trillion.
Yes, somewhere close around to that. Yes.
So where do we get that money from?
So basically, the public sector currently spends that money, about mm-hmm. 200 billion, as you indicated, more than that now actually. And then, in addition to that, the employers, the question you asked me earlier, employers will be contributing into the fund, as well as employees that earn above a particular tax bracket will be contributing into the fund.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be, broadly speaking, the streams of funding. In addition to that, there's other forms of taxation that the Treasury is looking at the end of the day. So we think that with that amount, we would be able to provide a comprehensive set of services. I disagree with Dr. Mahanjana. I don't know where he gets his trillion rand from. You can actually say you're going shopping and you can have an astronomical figure to say, I go shopping and my groceries cost me 10,000. Well, it could cost you 10,000 depending how you select the items, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you decide to buy. So the question becomes, what are you going to actually put into your package? That's the key issue. Yeah.
Does the compliance, the Office of the Health Standard Compliance, right. does they then do they then also determine what the price should be or what the cost should be, and if your costs are way higher than that, then you can opt out?
No, the Office of Standards Compliance deals only with quality. So they go in and are an inspectorate.
Only with quality?
Yes.
So who deals with cost?
So the fund deals with cost. So in other words, the fund will negotiate with the provider and say, this is what we think will be a reasonable reimbursement rate. Mm-hmm. These are your costs to run your practice. This is a reasonable income for you. So this is what we think we'll be able to pay you.
Mm-hmm.
That is the way the negotiation will happen. And a lot of the numbers that we've done thus far say the numbers can be much lower than what they are currently.
And the taxes, the models that we are looking at, does it include VAT?
So the Treasury has, in one of their models in the white paper, I think it's chapter 8 that has it, there is a adjustment on VAT. At that time, they were playing with various increases in VAT from 0.25 up to 1%. Depending on how that will play out, I think Treasury will have to make that decision.
Sibongile, I'd love to hear your remarks on this. We've already complained that VAT was increased by just 1% about, what was it, 2 years ago, and now chances of it being increased yet again.
You know, the problem with us here in South Africa, especially with our government, we like to shop with the money that we don't have. So even with NHI, that's what the government is planning to do. They are saying that, as he says now, to say, we'll buy what we have, with what we have. We don't have money. They should just say it, because the money that they are talking about, they will be taking money from HIV conditional grant, they will be taking money from, and people will suffer. So whatever they are saying, whatever he's saying, it's not realistic. And I'm still saying it, with the level of corruption that we have, I don't see NHI giving us the quality of healthcare services as we would like to have as poor people on the ground. Mm. Because people who will be getting more money, as the gentleman asked here, is the private sector, because our clinics, as the Office of the Health Standard just gave a report, I think it was 2 years back, to say out of 696 clinics that were surveyed, only 5 clinics from the public sector that have at least reached 80%. They're not 100%. So it means all the money that they'd be, the money of health, it will go to private sector, because they will be having all these beautiful hospitals with all this machinery, and they'll have everything.
Would it play out that way, Dr. Pillay? And then I'll ask Dr. Patel to also respond to this, because that is in relation to the question that was asked by Bongani earlier on, that would it lead to there being more pressure in the private sector?
Not necessarily, depending on which part of the private sector we're talking about. So certainly the primary care providers in the private sector, your general practitioners, your pharmacies, your dentists, etc., would be seeing far more patients than they're seeing now, certainly, because currently patients that go to the public sector currently go in queue in the outpatient department. So those patients will now be channeled through a primary care approach,
mm-hmm.
which would include all of these providers I just mentioned. So certainly that would happen. But you're not going to walk into a private hospital and say, I decided I'm going to come here today. Remember, the hospitals under an NHI environment will be classified by speciality, so whether it's cardiology, renal disease, pulmonary disease, etc. So you will be channeled to the hospital that has that specialization in it. So you're not going to walk in and say, I decided I'm coming here today because I like this hospital. No, your general practitioner will decide that you are sick and that you need to see a specialist. Mm-hmm. You will see the specialist relevant to your
disease.
And
where do I get this general practitioner?
You will choose your general practitioner.
So I can go to any GP, even if it is a private GP. So I can walk into a GP in Houghton and say that, hey, I've got a little problem here. So what do you think? Do you think I should go to a hospital? And then who decides which hospital I go to?
So the GP that you're going to go to is the GP you registered with, your family GP, the person that you usually go to. You don't randomly choose GPs, right? You say, when I register for the NHI...
I've got a bit of a problem there, because how many poor people do you know have a family doctor?
Well, they don't, because they come into the public sector.
Exactly.
But under the NHI, they're going to have a family doctor because there's a doctor in the community, but they can't go to him because they can't afford him.
Yes.
Now they're going to afford him because the fund is going to be paying.
Yeah.
So they will choose that GP. That will be their family GP.
What happens then to primary healthcare? What happens to the role that clinics play?
Clinics will be part of the system that, as Dr. Gumede mentioned, it's a multidisciplinary team. Mm. Primary care nurses, etc., are part of that team, yes.
Okay. Dr. Patel? Just a minute, unfortunately.
No, I was finding this debate quite interesting. I think the bottom line is the NHI debate, it's about funding issues, and it's one component of the health system reforms we need to carry out. I think the critical component is the service provision reforms that we need. The public don't necessarily know about the GPs, and you talk about your local GP. That's provided your GP decides he's willing to contract.
Yeah.
To the NHI. So if your GP chooses not to contract to that NHI, you have to go find another one.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of the clinics, yeah, potentially all the public sector clinics might be included as long as they meet the officer standards compliance criteria, etc. And hopefully there's a lot of effort between now and then that's been put in to really turn around those clinics. Majority of professionals that are working in the public sector and the private sector, they use their professional knowledge to treat patients in the same way possible. Mm. It's the resources around them to assist them in treating patients that are different between the private sector and public sector. And it is that component that we need to fix. Yes, I did comment earlier about the quality of care not that great. That also needs to be improved. That'll be the CPDs the doctors go through, the retraining about certain primary care procedures that have to be done in the primary care setting. For example, circumcision, you can't go and send it out to the private hospital anymore to get it done at whatever 5,000 to 10,000 rand type of thing. Can be done in the rooms for a couple of hundred rand. We will train the doctors. We need to train the doctors to do it in the rooms. Those who don't want to do it, well, that's something they're going to have to decide on the contracting basis and things like that.
Okay, so we're going to go to Power News. When we come back, the conversation still continues, and the aspect that we will be focusing on when we come back as well is how does the rural communities, or how do rural communities benefit from the NHI, considering the long distances that they have to travel for to various health facilities. But an interesting aspect that Dorcas Lekganyana also wants to bring into this conversation as well is traditional medical health researchers and traditional medicine, and where does it find expression within the NHI?
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.